there's still a lot left to say about the decision that came from the Supreme Court now a week ago overturning Roe versus Wade. There are legal fights in various states, including here in Utah, about whether state constitutions provide protections for abortion. The questions about access are still unclear, about how far these different states will go in restricting abortion now that the court has said they can. So this is very much still a story in play. The other part that's still out there are the stories we're hearing from women about their experiences with abortion, like this one. Jill Alger James came into the station this week and told us her story. She had just graduated from Skyline High School. In fact, she just celebrated her 18th birthday.
I was working up at Camp Rogers up in the Uintas. I was sicker than a dog. And then I missed a period. So I came down to Salt Lake City and had a pregnancy test and found out I was pregnant. My boyfriend and I went to his house and tried to figure out what to do. We thought long and hard about it, talked about all the possibilities. I remember just laying there on his bed, not knowing what to do, and he's crying. I was leaving in August to go to college. I could have had a baby and married this guy that I really loved, but I didn't want to. I wasn't ready to be a mother. I didn't want that to be my story. I wanted to have an abortion. We had it all planned so that my parents wouldn't find out about it. My boyfriend took me to the clinic. It was emotional, for sure. And then it was done. I think I was more afraid of getting caught than that procedure. But I remember when I was at my mother's house and she was going through the mail and I saw the information from the clinic. I just literally saw the color go out of her body, and she looked at me and she said, "Jill, did you have an abortion?" I said, "Yes, I did, and it's all your fault," and ran out of the house. We never talked about it again.
Ladies and gentlemen,
fast forward.
The Chief Justice of the United States, who will administer the presidential oath of office to William Jefferson Clinton, Chief Justice.
Clinton had won, and it was his inauguration. I'm at my parents' house.
I, William Jefferson Clinton, do solemnly swear.
The men of our family were Republican, and the women were Democrats. So all the Republicans were out of the house, and all the Democrats were there. My mom and her sisters. And they started talking about women, women's rights, and somehow, and I don't remember how, they started talking about the abortion my grandmother had had. I had never heard that my grandmother had had an abortion. She had given birth to 5 kids. The doctor had told my grandfather, "Bill, don't get Beatrice pregnant again or she'll die." And Bill got Beatrice pregnant. And so he took her to Idaho to have a back alley abortion. I just sat there. I didn't say anything. I just listened to them talk. Found out my grandmother's sister had had an abortion, that my aunt had a shotgun wedding. I mean, none of these things were ever talked about. Sex happened outside of marriage. It was never talked about. Fast forward again, my daughter, my youngest daughter, told me that she had applied to be a teen council member with Planned Parenthood. I took McCall for a walk. Oh. And I told her my abortion story. That's the first time I really remember telling it. I told her about her great-grandmother's abortion. Generation to generation, it's not a secret anymore. My kids know about my abortion, and they also have the resources for the things they need not to get pregnant.
Jill Alger James. She's a licensed clinical social worker in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. One of the things we wanted to understand this week is the Utah experience with abortion. That is, how Utah culture and politics, Utah society, I guess, is going to influence the impact of the Supreme Court ruling last week. We spoke with Dr. Misha Pangasa this week. She's an obstetrician and gynecologist in Salt Lake City, specializes in contraception and abortion care. And we began with the question of where Utah fits in comparison to other states on this issue. Materially speaking, is Utah different? Not necessarily in its abortion laws or its sentiments about reproductive rights, but in terms of women seeking abortions over the course of their lives, is Utah different? Pangasa told us, not really.
From my own experience providing abortion care to patients in Utah, people seek abortion for the same reasons. The same sort of demographics of patients come to us. The biggest difference is just in comparison to some other states in this country, there's a lot of obstacles and a lot of hoops to jump through in order to actually get to the point of having an abortion appointment.
But women in Utah who seek abortions, they're seeking abortions for the same reasons everyone else is.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Do we know how many women in Utah have abortions over the course of their lives? Do we have a sense of that number?
So in the United States, generally, we say about one in every four women will have had an abortion by the time that they're 45. In Utah, the numbers that I can say are that we typically have around 2,500 to 3,000 abortions a year. So take that with the population of Utah. And, you know, that's sort of the best numbers that I have about that.
So that particular number, how do we compare that with the—
Utah actually has one of the lowest abortion rates in the country.
Right. Of course, the question is why?
And it's a great question. To be honest with you, I don't think that there's research data to answer exactly why Utah has a lower abortion rate than the rest of the country. You know, we certainly know that there is religious dynamics mm-hmm. that are different in this state than are in other states. And I can say just from my own experience, there are reasons that people would terminate a pregnancy in other states that there are more people in Utah who wouldn't.
From the women you encounter or from the providers you talk to who have provided abortions to women who call themselves Latter-day Saints, mm-hmm. is there any distinction? Is there any difference in that experience in some way that you can say?
You know, it's one that's difficult for me to speak to
sure.
because, you know, we don't necessarily delve deep into people's faith as we talk to them about their evidence-based options.
Right.
What I can say is that we know that in the overall population of the United States, about 60% of women who seek abortion are religiously affiliated in some way, shape, or form. And I have certainly cared for LDS patients.
Yeah.
And there are reasons that they seek abortion that are the same as everybody else. And there are reasons that many LDS women choose not to have abortions that are the same as other people as well.
Right.
So it certainly is a possibility that that's contributing to the lower abortion rate in Utah. But at the end of the day, it's hard to make real generalizations about who each of these individual women and who these families are.
Yeah. Do we know when in the course of their lives they seek abortions? I mean, one statistic I've seen said that like 59%, I think, was the statistic that women who already have children – they already have children when they seek an abortion. Does that square with what you seem to understand?
Absolutely. That's an accurate statistic that most women, so 59% of women who come seeking abortion, already have children. And most commonly, the reason that they are often seeking abortion is because they're concerned about providing for the children they already have. We know that most women who seek abortions are actually in their 20s or 30s, mm-hmm. And it's a minority who are younger or older than that.
So what does it say that 59% already have children and are seeking an abortion, that this is a measure of family planning? What does that tell us?
I mean, I think it tells us that women know what it means to go through a pregnancy. They know what childbirth entails. They know what the recovery from childbirth entails. They know what parenting entails. And I've seen a lot of patients who would choose to continue pregnancies if they felt like they had more resources to take care of the children they already had or the pregnancy that they are currently experiencing.
I guess we need to make a distinction between what it was like for a woman in Utah to have an abortion or try to access an abortion before last Friday and what it will be like in those coming weeks or months, I guess, when the restrictive law takes effect. What was it like?
So,
or what is it like, I guess, because we're still there.
We're still there right now, fortunately.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that is probably a little bit different in Utah is the amount of stigma and the amount of, I think, shame in communities that exist. And so not only do women experience that, I think, in their communities, but then the Utah legislature has created enough roadblocks to tell women, you don't really know what you want. Let us tell you. Let us tell you that the state of Utah prefers adoption over abortion. The state of Utah requires you, and again, remember that most of these women are already mothers, but the state of Utah requires us to tell you what every stage of pregnancy is like and requires you to go through an online module to speak to a physician about it, wait 72 hours, and then be able to schedule an appointment.
So the experience in Utah, how does it compare to other like states nearby?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked this. I've been fortunate to practice in other states that are less restrictive when it comes to abortion care. And two things tend to be true. Number one, accessing abortion is much easier in those states.
Yeah.
But states that are hostile to abortion care also actually, my personal experience is that women receive worse early pregnancy care, worse contraception care, worse care when it comes to miscarriage. Fewer social safety nets.
One of the things that we're hearing a lot about lately is how, you know, the most profound effects of the Supreme Court ruling are going to fall on women who lack resources, who are in extremists. But you're pushing back on that a little bit. And I wanted to ask you about this because what you've said to us is this is going to impact all women in all circumstances. What's the point you're making there?
Yeah. And to be clear, I don't want to detract from the
For
fact
sure.
that
right.
people with the fewest resources will certainly be affected by this.
Yes.
I think that people don't even realize all of the downstream implications of this Supreme Court decision. Like I was saying, the way that early pregnancy is managed, the way that miscarriage is managed, the way that contraception is talked about, the availability of providers to provide certain procedures when people are experiencing fetal demises or when they have stillbirths, when they have miscarriages, the ability to have trained providers to take care of them in the most evidence-based ways, to provide them with the most number of options, like all of that is going to be different. And not only that, we know that childbirth in and of itself is about 15 times more dangerous than an early abortion. And so that is something that's going to affect everybody. And we are definitely going to see an increase in pregnancy-related morbidity and, unfortunately, pregnancy-related mortality in this country.
Doctor, what do you think it means to have bodily autonomy, do you think? When a woman loses that control, how does it alter her life? And not just in the practical terms, which you can go through, but what does it mean for a woman to believe she doesn't have complete agency over her body?
I think when you recognize that the minute that you have a positive pregnancy test, you no longer have control of your own body is an extremely disheartening thing for anyone who has the capability to be pregnant in this country. Just to know that the second a positive pregnancy test enters your life is no longer your own. And the priorities of the state and the priorities of the country are towards a pregnancy growing inside of you, and your heartbeat and your brain and your body are no longer a priority.
There are some practical things I did want to ask you about that were related to this question. Women who are denied abortions, and I'm not sure if these numbers are exactly accurate, but something like four times more likely to live below the poverty line. Also a lot more likely to be single parents, to stay in abusive relationships, to be unemployed or on public assistance. And there was a study, I think it's called the Turnaway Study, that laid out some of this. Would you take us through some of that?
Yeah, absolutely. So this was a really well-done study with 30 abortion clinics throughout the United States, so in multiple different places, followed thousands of women for 5 years. They followed women who went to abortion clinics and were able to obtain the abortions that they decided on. And then they also followed women who were denied or turned away from an abortion because they were above the gestational age limit at that clinic, or they couldn't afford it, or various other reasons why they were not able to actually have the abortion that they sought. And so they followed all of these women for 5 years, and they found the things that you just mentioned, that 95% of women at 5 years said that it was the right decision for them, the ones who were able to obtain a legal abortion. The women who were able to obtain an abortion were more likely to break contact with violent partners. The women who were denied an abortion were more likely to remain in poverty, unable to provide for basic necessities such as food, housing, and transportation for themselves and the children that they already had. They actually followed developmental milestones for the children of women while they were seeking abortion, and found that women who were able to obtain the abortion that they sought, the children that they already had, were more likely to kind of meet some of the developmental milestone assessments than women who were denied an abortion. So we know that the impact on women's lives, on their families, on the children that they already have, and on their future prospects is proven to be significant if they are denied an abortion that they're seeking.
So we talked about a moment ago what it was like and what it sort of is now like, you know, before this decision came. What's it going to be like when the more restrictive law goes into effect, which seems like that's what's going to happen?
It very much seems like that is going to happen. And I'll be honest that I'm still crossing my fingers for a miracle here in Utah. But to be honest with you, I'm terrified of what that's going to look like here. And I, like I said before, I don't think anyone is truly prepared for all of the downstream consequences. So we're going to see women who don't have the resources to obtain an abortion. And so we're going to see an increase in our birth rate. And we don't have baby formula. You know, we don't have the safety nets or the ways to help so many women already. And we already see so much pregnancy-related morbidity and mortality. And that is just going to increase. We're going to see women who are seeking abortion have a much more treacherous journey to it. We already live in a place where it's so stigmatized and people have to listen to protesters yelling at them and telling them that they know what's better for their lives. And now they're going to have to try to do this in even more secret. It is heartbreaking to me that they wouldn't be able to just come to us as physicians who know how to provide this care safely, but that our hands will be tied from helping them through these journeys. And they're going to feel scared, and a lot of them are going to leave the state. They're going to leave the state to get their abortion care. And to be honest with you, I think that we will see people just leave the state, period, and try to go to a place where they're going to get better early pregnancy care. They're going to get better miscarriage care. They're going to get better access to contraception. And they're going to feel safe that if they enter a circumstance in which they're facing one of the most difficult decisions of their lives, they're going to be able to talk to doctors about it.
Dr. Misha Pangasa, she's a board-certified obstetrician and gynecologist in Salt Lake City. She specializes in contraception and abortion care. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Listener support is at the heart of KUER. You can easily manage your donation at any time using MyKUER. It's a place for you to update your contact information, find tax receipts, and change your giving amount. Got a new credit card or debit card, or maybe you want to switch to a direct donation from your bank account? Yep, you can do that too. Stay up to date with MyKUER. Log in or sign up today at KUER.org/MyKUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Erica Munson is a member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, comes from an LDS family here in Salt Lake City. And this week, she told us something she says has become part of the family lore. For as long as she can remember, her family has told the story of her cousin, Betsy.
All of us cousins knew the story of my cousin Betsy's birth. Her mom, Aunt Marla, had been told very early on that if she were to get pregnant, she might not survive a pregnancy. So she and Uncle Bill adopted two kids, And a few years later, she had an unwanted, unplanned pregnancy. She could not get an abortion. Her doctor would not do it, even though it could leave two kids motherless. It could have been a story that challenged abortion. It could have been, look at beautiful Betsy, because she was born incredibly premature, especially for those days. Wasn't expected to survive, but she did, and it was a miracle. But nobody in my family used that as an argument against abortion. We're interested in our origins. We're interested in our relationships. This is who we are. We knew the horrible place that my aunt and uncle had been in. My aunt had to be on bed rest for 9 months, full of worry. The anger and sorrow that my elders felt about that was communicated to all of us. Six or seven years later, 1973, my family and I were coming back from a summer vacation. Kids are in the back of the station wagon. Mom's driving, Dad's there, and they're talking about Roe v. Wade, their support for it. We're suddenly super interested in what they're talking about. And my dad is seeing this as a teaching moment. And he turns to us in the back seat and he says, an abortion is a very sad thing, but a child coming into this world unwanted is tragic. The sincerity and the power of that statement has guided my life in terms of my feeling about reproductive agency. The LDS concept of free agency is something that pervaded our lives and was an important part of our faith. Often we're given two competing goods by God to choose from. And the story of Eve is actually one of those things. The way LDS people read that story is that Eve is given a commandment to multiply and replenish the earth, but also don't eat from the fruit of the tree of knowledge. You couldn't do one without the other. She had to decide, am I going to break the commandment about the tree of knowledge and multiply? And she did. And LDS people give her all the credit for making that decision, for moving forward into mortality, which LDS people believe is an essential part of eternal progress.
That's why you say, based on your faith, a woman's right to control her reproductive destiny is sacred.
Absolutely. I believe that is sacred space. I believe it's a sacred experience. That's the experience I've had in 7 pregnancies, 5 of which have resulted in kids. I also had 2 miscarriages. I felt like I've been a partner with God in deciding the timing and deciding whether or not I'm going to do it. It's about you and God making that decision. It's not anybody else's decision.
That's Erica Munson. She's co-founder of the group Mormons Building Bridges. A week after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, we're continuing this ongoing conversation about the fallout from the ruling, exploring what happens now in Utah. And it's this religion part you really have to address to understand that. Because while the position of the LDS Church on abortion is much like other conservative faiths, its doctrine makes it more complicated. The church opposes elective abortions, but it allows far more exceptions than other religions. And the Mormon worldview, the cosmology at the heart of the faith, gives women more flexibility when it comes to this idea of personal agency. We spoke with Carolyn Homer this week. She's an attorney in Washington, D.C., also an active Latter-day Saint. She writes for the Mormon blog By Common Consent.
So the LDS Church officially opposes elective abortions, but I think there's a lot there. And what does the word elective mean, right? Because what is a non-elective abortion? That presupposes that exists. And the church then defines what it considers to be acceptable categories there. So rape, incest, health or life of the mother, or severe fetal defects that will invariably result in the death of the unborn child, should it be born. And so when you add up all those categories, that means that abortion itself has to be possible in some circumstances. Mm-hmm. And then once it has to be possible, whose job is it to decide whether or not to get one and how? And I think where the church has really come down without saying this is abortion is a medical procedure they want to leave to medical professionals and the women who are seeking it without government interference at some level, right? You can't have those exceptions be validly recognized and acted on with prayer if the government is also interfering in the decision.
Wait, so what you're saying is the official LDS church position could be construed as this is a woman's choice?
I think that that's one way to say it, is that they have taken a strong moral position. Yeah. That abortion, especially elective abortion, is a sin,
yeah,
but that certain types of abortion are not sins and could be a woman's choice based off of prayer, you know, mm, or they are a medical tragedy, but it has to be available.
Hmm. So if you're a mainstream active Latter-day Saint, is it clear the church's position on abortion? Is it all foggy or a little confusing, or does it seem fairly clear to most Mormons?
I think most Latter-day Saint women think it's clear until they hit medical reality, is the short answer. So which gets to your foggy definition, right, is elective abortion is a sin. Using abortion as a form of birth control is a sin. If the fetus is otherwise viable, you should do everything in your power to keep it. Even in cases of rape, right? There's a lot of women I know who debate, well, it's not the baby's fault, so maybe I should carry it to term.
In Mormon circles, they're having this debate.
In Mormon circles, they're having this debate.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Like, I think I personally would not be able to get an abortion for a non-medical reason.
Yeah.
I can't see myself doing that. But I know other women who, whether victims of abuse or sexual trauma, you know, come out differently personally there. So like those theological conversations happen. And I think they know that that ends up being a personal decision subject to prayer and kind of theological conversation. What I think a lot of women get foggy on is how some medical terminology maps onto the word abortion. So every time this debate gets reactivated in social media, what I see in a lot of Mormon forums or among Latter-day Saint friends is they start telling the stories of the ectopic pregnancies or the severe birth defects. Mm-hmm. And they start saying, you know, oh, I was taken to a Catholic hospital and they had to call a review board to give me this life-saving procedure. And I was horrified, right, that there were so many layers of interference with what was obviously the best medical decision. And I remember there was one post several years ago that went viral where the woman like didn't even realize the procedure they were proposing technically legally counted as abortion until she started hitting red tape. And so I think that's where a lot of the nuance and debate happens, where a lot of Latter-day Saint women in medical situations or in rape, abuse, incest situations are not sure how the morality plays out.
I wanted to ask you about the sin part of this. How egregious a sin is an elective abortion in the LDS Church? Could a woman, could a provider be excommunicated, be expelled from the church for that, do you think?
I do not believe it is the church's official position that a woman could get excommunicated for an abortion. I believe that she has to repent. I believe they consider it very serious. I know the handbook says it is not akin to murder.
Huh. Huh.
There's been some rhetorical debate about that in general conference talks and sermons over the decades. But as of right now, it's abortion is not officially murder, which tracks our position on stillbirths and miscarriages, which is that those were not, you know, spirit or the or basically naturally occurring unborn children who are not viable do not receive a spirit. in LDS church theology.
All right, I want to focus on that because that really does get us to, as you say, the theology, the sort of cosmological view within the faith. Because there's the official position, which seems pretty straightforward, but then there's how the practice of abortion works in this LDS cosmology. Because Latter-day Saints believe, just for those who don't get this, they believe there's this pre-existent state and that a spirit in this pre-existent state comes to Earth to get a body. So how does it work when you're talking about a fetus, do you think? When do Latter-day Saints believe that the spirit comes into the body? And how does that influence the way Latter-day Saints think about abortion?
So my understanding is that the official theological position is that if a baby is born and takes even one breath, the spirit entered the body of the baby. And if it tragically dies immediately thereafter, you know, the spirit has possessed a body and then it is going to the spirit world and has an automatic pass to the celestial kingdom because it was sinless.
Thrown off by the breath thing. Do you mean the breath in the womb possibly as well, right? Like
my understanding, and I actually spent some time, you know, looking at old theological statements, is it has to be born exterior. Like the baby has to be born because I know a lot of women who have had miscarriages or even very, very late term stillbirths. And they have been heartbroken or they have wanted to add, you know, the name of their stillborn child to their family genealogical records, or they have wanted to get religious ordinances done on behalf of that child. And they have received letter after letter after letter from my friends who have gone through this incredible pain, saying there's no official theological position, that temple ordinances cannot be done on behalf of stillborn or miscarried children, and that it has to have been a baby who was born and lived, even if only for a few seconds, outside the womb. And so when you're coming from that backdrop, then abortion presumably follows the same theological basis, that an aborted fetus is a potential life. It is a life that would have received a spirit, but it is not necessarily already a spirit child of God. My understanding is there's been theological debate about this.
Sure.
There has been a sort of a sense of we'll find out more when we get to heaven, and that there's been an openness that we may be wrong, but that has been the line that has been drawn for the last several decades.
This idea that you often hear within the faith is that, look, some of the stuff we don't know. We'll find out later.
Because
it makes me wonder then in that sense, just how malleable is the church's position or how malleable is Mormon doctrine? Because it seems like a person of any ideology almost can find something in that doctrine to make it fit with their worldview. Because we're hearing from a lot of Latter-day Saint women who are absolutely able to adapt and justify their pro-choice beliefs into their beliefs about Mormonism.
Yes. I do think it's fairly malleable. And I think when you look at the exceptions that the church has come up with, right, even if those exceptions only apply in, you know, 5 to 10% of cases, it still means abortion has to be legal for some, right? Or if you think about just like the theological moral debate about when does life begin for purposes of triggering either a religious or a governmental interest in protecting the unborn, I think the church recognizes is more in the early stages of pregnancy a religious question than a legal one or a biological one. And so because of that ambiguity and because of all of the answers we don't have on miscarriages and stillbirths, a lot of women have felt the ability to kind of carve out their own moral, political beliefs in this realm.
Yeah. So what are you hearing from Latter-day Saint women? What are you hearing? What are the stories you're hearing? How are they talking about this? And I'm wondering, are you hearing a difference between different generations of Latter-day Saints? Like, are younger Mormon women thinking about this in different ways than others? What are you hearing, I guess?
Well, so I certainly see an older generation who just kind of assumes that the worst of the rhetoric is true about Roe v. Wade, that these were our women who want to be able to murder their children so they don't take responsibility at any time for any reason up to 40 weeks. And that's just not the rhetoric that's real. In my experience, 60% of abortions, I believe, according to the Guttmacher Institute, are to women living below the poverty line who don't have access to health care or child care.
Yeah.
Right. When we go back to agency, it's, even if they wanted a baby, they literally couldn't afford it in a country that doesn't provide any additional support. And then other huge percentages, or maybe not huge, but statistically significant percentages, do in fact deal with domestic violence, abuse, medical emergencies, medical defects, health of the mother. And so I definitely see a lot more nuance in the debate among 20 and 30 year olds because they're used to publicly talking about reproductive health as a medical issue.
Yeah. It gets us to something you've written about, and that is this question of what does as you've put it, a fulsome pro-life society look like? How do you build, as you put it, a culture that celebrates life? Because you can't stop at protecting the unborn. Say something about that, if you would.
I think it's been just statistically proven in our country and in others that if you provide health care and support to women, you end up with fewer abortions and more wanted children. So when you give free birth control, for example, that you just have enormously fewer teenage pregnancies. And if you provide more health care so that a woman who doesn't have insurance, let me back up. I literally just had my first baby. The insurance bill that got fully paid with a very minor copay on my end was $25,000 for the birth of a baby with no complications. It was the smoothest process that I could imagine, and it's still $25,000, right? Mm. That's the federal poverty line, right? That's half of Americans. There is no world in which they can afford that. They don't have insurance. And so we have to come up with a system that covers that, right? Even if we don't adopt universal health care for everyone, universal coverage of child expenses, including birth, would be a start. To not make it feel crippling financially just to have a baby and bring it to term.
Do you think that now that people who are against abortion rights have a victory that they're talking about, do you think that the conversation will head that way now, talking more about the kind of support for mothers and pregnant women and children facing poverty?
I hope so. I genuinely hope so. I will confess that given the current political climate, I am not optimistic because what I'm seeing already is in states, blue states where abortion is still legal because the immediate effect of the Supreme Court's decision was to return it to the states to set their own abortion regulation. There's a groundswell of people seeking to cut back those permissions, right? So they're still fighting the abortion. We need to ban it fight. In the states where it is banned, those same states also have a culture against socialized medicine, against welfare, against accepting Obamacare or Medicaid expansion. And I don't think that's going to change just because abortion is now banned. The rhetoric I'm seeing is still one of, well, the woman was promiscuous. The woman was irresponsible. She should just never have had sex. This is the consequence. And I really wish that we would have a society that would care for mothers and caregivers. And that's why I wrote this post, is because I want to really focus on what supporting life means, but I'm not optimistic that we're going to get there.
That's Carolyn Homer. She's an attorney in Washington, D.C., writes for the Mormon blog By Common Consent. You can find a link to her writing on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER's live programming is available 24/7 wherever it's most convenient for you. Find us on your radio at 90.1 or on one of our other frequencies across the state. Stream us at KUER.org or by downloading the free KUER mobile app. Your smart speaker is also a convenient way to stay connected to NPR Utah. Just tell your device to play KUER. Learn more about how to listen by going to KUER.org/listen.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's been a week now since the Supreme Court overturned the landmark Roe versus Wade decision that said abortion was a right found in the Constitution. We're exploring the Utah experience with abortion today. The conversation about the LDS Church's position is important because the lawmakers who have passed and will be passing laws about abortion in this state are predominantly Mormon. So the politics are interesting. And for insight about that, we reached out to Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune. He's a columnist for the paper these days, but has spent his share of time covering this issue at the legislature. How would you describe the abortion legislation that's been debated and put forward, you know, over the last few decades? And is this typical of what you would see in a conservative state with a supermajority of conservative Republicans?
I think maybe it started out a little less typical, but has become more typical. Hmm. A lot of states are now following what other states have already done. And we saw that in the case of when in 2019, when Utah passed its 18-week ban, banning abortion after 18 weeks. That was sort of following on what other states were doing. They were looking at 15 to 18-week prohibitions, trying to get those in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. And so it's sort of become a national trend. And we see that in the fallout from this, where 13 states have trigger laws. Other states have laws that were already on the books with largely banning abortion.
So give us a sense of the, I guess, the history or the political history of abortion laws in Utah, how it's evolved over the last several years.
I mean, if we back up to the 50s, the only allowance for abortion was to protect the life of the mother. We didn't have the rape and incest exceptions came in later. That's not to say there weren't prosecutions of women or doctors who performed abortions prior to that. There were about 14 between that period of statehood and the court's ruling in Roe. After that, it sort of became more about setting up as many barriers as you could. And that's when we started seeing 24-hour waiting periods. And then we saw those extending. We saw the court initially, actually, in the early stages, require the consent of the father, the biological father, to get an abortion. You know, we saw these videos that or pamphlets that people either had to read or the videos they had to watch, sort of prodding people, showing them pictures of a fetus and so forth. And so that's kind of where they were going. They were trying to put up as many of these obstacles as they could to try to steer women away from it. And it's probably worth noting that Utah does have one of the, if not the lowest, one of the lowest rates of abortion in the United States. It's about a third of the national average. And so I'm not saying that's because of that. I think it's always been low. And it's been coming down for the last 20 years. And so, you know, it's probably a complex factors at play, part of it being the obstacles put in place. But part of it is just the culture, I think, is less likely than other states to go down that path.
Well, you mentioned the culture. So that, you know, this question you have to ask, how much is the LDS Church position on abortion influenced the laws that have been debated in past? I mean, the church, of course, is against abortion on moral grounds, but it allows for more exceptions than some of the other conservative Christian faiths. So how much has that influenced the way Utah lawmakers have fine-tuned their, you know, abortion legislation?
Yeah, I mean, I think you haven't seen lawmakers willing to start going after some of those exceptions that are in place, the rape, incest, life of the mother, severe defect to the fetus, because those are all enshrined in the Mormon position on this issue. And so they've kind of towed that line. Now, if you look at the church's involvement on this issue in particular compared to other issues, I mean, they haven't been nearly as involved on abortion as they have in, say, you know, same-sex marriage.
Yeah.
You know, we saw Prop 8 in California and their big involvement there. The statements that you see from the brethren at conference are more directed at, you know, same-sex marriage, religious freedom, issues like that.
You hardly ever hear, you know, Latter-day Saint general authorities talking much about abortion at all over the last 20 years or so.
Yeah, it's not an issue that they've let out on for whatever reason. I mean, we can speculate on the reasons for that. And, you know, if you look back at the history, I had a friend that lobbied for a long time for Planned Parenthood, and she said that she could speak the language to some of the LDS legislators, you know, because there is this concept in the LDS doctrine about quickening. It's something Brigham Young talked about, when the soul enters the body. And prior to that, you don't have a person. So that's when it attains personhood. So that gave them some wiggle room, I think, in those early days.
So wait, so what you're saying is some abortion rights advocates may have taken that wiggle room within Mormon doctrine as a way to maybe influence lawmakers when they're thinking about how extreme their laws are going to be.
I mean, it gave them an out, I guess. If they didn't want to go all the way to, you know, the extreme position that some of the other red states might be advocating, you know, the South, for example, then they could sort of, you know, they had an avenue that they could kind of, from a philosophical standpoint, rationalize that.
Were there factions within the Republican Party that emerged in these conversations over abortion legislation over time? Because it seems like, I know a bit of this history, the people who were sort of passing these more extreme laws were more extreme versions of, you know, were part of a more extreme faction in the Republican Party. And you had more moderate Republicans who were willing to go along with abortion legislation, but not willing to go so far.
Yeah, I mean, I think we saw this around the country too in the 80s and 90s. It was much more common to have pro-choice Republicans. I think in the 90s and 2000s and now 2020s, that's become a rarity. You know, the pro-choice Republicans are few and far between. In this last Senate election, we saw Becky Edwards, who said that she didn't see a reason Roe needed to be revisited, you know, when she was running against Mike Lee in this Republican primary. But that's a rare exception. Now, that's not necessarily a rare exception among Republican voters, but among Republican candidates and in the Republican platform. They've taken a hard line that wants to do away with abortion rights in the country. And so a pro-choice Republican is an endangered species these days.
So it raises the question of how much the populist MAGA Trump faction of the Republican Party is growing among lawmakers, because that faction seems, you know, more doctrinaire on these matters like abortion. So are lawmakers, do you think their positions, are they becoming more extreme and therefore the abortion law will become more extreme? I mean, and how extreme can it get? Are you seeing laws that are passing throughout the country that include no exceptions whatsoever, some in place?
Yeah.
And then laws like in Florida and Texas that call on private citizens to sue clinics and doctors and private citizens. You know, would Utah go that far?
I mean, I think clearly Utah's followed the trend nationally where the strident Republicans have become more extreme on that issue. And I have heard that there is some talk about, you know, maybe the exceptions we have in place are too broad. Maybe we need to tighten those up. I would not be at all surprised to see if somebody proposes this civil lawsuit against, you know, against somebody who receives or performs an abortion. I think all of those are on the table. Now, it's not to say that I think they'll pass or that I think that represents a majority of the body, but there are people in the legislature who I think would like to see that happen. And so, and as proof of that, I think we've seen, you know, we were one of the early states to pass these, you know, near complete bans on abortion, except for, you know, very limited circumstances. So we're not necessarily at the vanguard of it, but we're, you know, right up there with them. And so I would anticipate that as this plays out, now that states do have much broader discretion in regulating this, as this plays out, I would expect that we'll see some of those things at least proposed and perhaps some of them coming pass into law. I would say that I think they probably do need to take another look at the abortion law that's in place, though. SB 174 has these limitations or exceptions on when you can have an abortion, but they're very nebulous, uniformly diagnosable and uniformly lethal defect of the fetus. Well, so if you can say it's only 99% lethal, then is the state going to force the woman to carry that to term, knowing that the chances of survival are very, very slim? I mean, it's not well defined. The reporting.
Why do you think that is? Because it raises the question of whether or not lawmakers who passed that law did it as just sort of a message bill or actually thought Roe would get overturned?
I think maybe some of both. I think if we go back a few years to the time when this was being considered, you know, Brett Kavanaugh was confirmed to the court in 2019. This bill passed in 2020. Amy Coney Barrett was confirmed later that year. I think in between that time, there was hope, at least, that they could take this controlling majority of the court and actually have a chance for the first time in four decades to get a case before the court that would overturn it. And so I think it was partly let's push this forward, and also, you know, we'll come back and figure it out later if the dog does end up catching the car, so to speak. So, you know, now they're in a situation where they have a law that is very difficult to work. I mean, the rape and incest exception, for example, I think is one where they says it has to be the doctor has to verify there's a report to law enforcement. Well, what does that mean? I mean, right. Does that mean that does there have to be proof that the pregnancy stemmed from the rape or incest? Or is it just if there's a report, then they're, you know. So there are some fine points that need to be worked out on this. Right now, again, the judge has put a temporary restraining order in place, keeping it from being enforced. They're going to have a preliminary injunction hearing on it in a couple weeks. That might give them some time to try to refine this, but I think eventually they're going to have to come back and refine it. And I think that's where you'll probably see a push for people to try to remove some of the restrictions and then maybe impose some more restrictions on when people can have this procedure.
So what do you think is going to change in Utah because of this? And maybe this gets at not just a sort of a political reflection, but how you're reflecting on this in a deeper way, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot that's going to change and maybe less that's going to change in some ways. I think as all of us, Doug, you and I, white guys talking about this issue, it doesn't necessarily hit home the way it does for, you know, if we talk to sisters, mothers, neighbors who are going to be directly impacted by this. I mean, it's rare in this country, if unprecedented, to lose a constitutional right, to have it stripped away. You know, and I think from on the political landscape, abortion's never been one of those issues that people have voted on. I mean, the political science indicates the issues that people care about are economy, jobs, education, healthcare, and so forth. Yeah. Because I think the assumption was that it will always be there. I think now that it's gone, it's a wake-up call, and I think people will, you know, in this upcoming election, turn out to vote on it. Whether it's enough to, you know, tip the scales, we don't know yet. But I think it's going to be much more front and center in the debate now.
Robert Gerke, he's a columnist at the Salt Lake Tribune. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, I'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. The show is produced by Carrie Watson, Benjamin Bombard, and Tim Slover. Stephanie Allerton is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.